Banjo Kelly Hunt joins the program now. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, Luke. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. I refer to you as Banjo Kelly because there's actually another Kelly Hunt in Kansas City where you live, isn't there?
That's right. Yep, we actually met for the first time in a radio station doing a show like yours. So.
Oh, how about that? Well, you know, Kelly Hunt, the blues piano player, has been a popular artist on KD&K for couple decades, I think. So,
well, I should hope so. She's wonderful.
Is she?
Wonderful. Yeah, she is. She's as lovely as a person as she is a musician and a writer. So I'm glad I can say that.
You know, I sort of have the feeling it might be the same with you, but that's only based. I could be wrong. You tell me. But, you know, it's funny because I guess your new album, Even the Sparrow, dropped a couple of months ago, but I only just became aware of it, and oh my God, it's just amazing. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I understand it took you a couple years to make.
It did. You know, I was just had been writing for years, but I really have only begun performing, gigging really in the past 5 years. So I had a lot to learn. I had a lot to learn about being in the studio. And so I just took my time making this album so that I could kind of be there and immerse myself in every step of the process and gain a vocabulary for, you know, how to be in the studio, how to navigate the studio and work with an engineer and what mixing is, what mastering is, all the different stages of the process. So, yeah, and then to piece these songs together and bring them to life in the way that I had envisioned them in my mind. We took our time, and I wanted something I could listen to forever and not feel like I'd, you know, made any compromises. So,
did you succeed?
I think so. It has stood the test of time. Uh-huh. We had the album remastered and tweaked a couple things from the first printing to the official release in May. Other than that, I mean, they were just real minor nuances. It's still an album I enjoy listening to, so that's good.
Well, let's talk a little bit about it. As I mentioned, it's called Even the Sparrow, and all the songs on there, except for one, actually, are written by you. Is that right?
They all are written by me, actually.
Yeah. Oh, even Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was written by you?
Oh, yes. It's the name is really kind of an homage to all of that, but it's a song I did write that's, a murder ballad. So, some of the titles, in fact, are popular folk songs, but just reimagined as my own songs and entirely different songs.
Well, I mentioned you as a banjo player, but I think you have another instrument there that you're equally adept at, and that's your voice. And from what I understand, that was your original instrument, the one that you first practiced. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, I absolutely. I consider that my primary instrument. It's, I've been singing since I could. And probably before, too. Probably trying before I really could. But I grew up in a household that was steeped in music and sang in choirs have been singing my whole life. So it's definitely the instrument I feel most connected and sort of fluent in. And then I picked up my first banjo seven, eight years ago. So it's relatively new. For me, but tenor banjo and five string banjo, and it was the perfect vessel for my songwriting, and that was just apparent as soon as I picked it up and started to try writing on it. Things were just flowing in a way they never had before. So,
Well, I want to get to the banjo in just a minute, but I want to compliment you on several things that I noticed from listening to the album. First of all, and I think this is a testament to your singing ability, is the way that you elongate some of those vowels and add certain vocal inflections just puts so much emotion into the words that you're singing. And that's a rare talent. I don't think a lot of people can say they get that, even as early as their first album.
Well, thank you for that. That's a really that's a really keen insight. I the voice, how I use my voice, it's very much, it's a vessel for those emotions, and that I hadn't even really articulated that thought in my mind before. But you're absolutely right.
Well, does that come? Does that come from the get-go, or does that come after singing a line many, many, many times? How does that work?
You know, I would say it's just kind of was natural to the song, which I think is why I don't think about it so much. It's just the song kind of suggests, an emotional context that needs to be communicated. And that's part of, performance for me, is I do tend to just get lost in the song and the emotion behind, the writing of the song. And so whatever the voice needs to do to communicate that, it just kind of supplies its own ideas. And funny, actually, now certain of those songs we play a little bit differently from what's on the album, because they were pretty fresh when we recorded them. And so some of them we actually even play a little bit differently now. But that is a stylistic thing I think I tend to do, and you're... Yeah, it's keen to pick up on that.
Well, I think that's what distinguishes. Well, for instance, when you think of Bob Dylan, you don't think of him as a great singer necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But if you listen to the way he does it, it adds so many layers of expression to the lyric. And I think that's what you've got.
Right.
You've got the same kind of ability to kind of invest the line with, and it just comes from the pacing and the vowels and all of it together. When you're writing these lyrics, are you reading them aloud? Is that kind of how you get the pacing, the tempo?
I'm really, especially with the songs on this album, they're really my earliest songs in terms of finished pieces. And so I was writing from a different place back then. It was very sort of unadulterated, pure, just these songs, pretty much all of them came pretty quickly. I didn't labor over these songs the way that I maybe do now writing. It's just different. But these kind of came out fully formed, and it was an experience. It was a beautiful experience for me. But I didn't feel like I was really trying too hard or writing, actively writing. It was just these things were coming out, and I was trying to capture them and record them before I lost them, essentially. But yeah, there is definitely, I started writing poetry as a kid before I ever wrote music. And so words mean a lot to me, and I read a lot, and the written word means a lot. So I do, stake a lot on the words. But sometimes, and in the case of this album, really, the melody and the words really did take shape together. And so it was kind of like, and sometimes the melody would come a little bit first, and the phrasing of certain melodic phrasings would come to me, and then the words just fit in naturally to that. And I didn't question too much, which I think is maybe the beauty of a first album.
Wow.
I didn't know the industry. I didn't know the standards. I was self-taught. And so I really was able to just kind of give myself over to the creative process in a really natural way.
Wow. And that natural way means sort of stepping aside and just letting it happen, not getting in your own way.
Exactly, which it gets harder to not do. Yeah,
wow.
Absolutely.
So has that dynamic changed? I know you've got another album close to completion, and maybe we'll talk about that in a minute, but you say that that your songwriting process has changed a little bit, so I hope it doesn't mean you forgot to get out of your own way.
I need to like record that little snippet and just play it back to myself like a mantra. But no, absolutely. That's really my main goal, is to just let, is to not get in my own way and to And it just gets more complicated, you know, when you get into making a living at something and all of sort of the logistics and the sort of practical business mind things you have to consider, all of that can kind of cloud. It's not conducive to creating. And so I've really learned, you know, especially now being on the road and things, that how to carve out the right time and the right headspace to be receptive in a way that I just was before, because my life was conducive to that. And so, yeah, it's all about, I think, kind of every day, everything that I do, I'm gathering fodder. You know, my life is my kindling. And then it's just a matter of carving out the time and space. But yeah, there's a lot of songs that are finished and waiting in the wings and ready to be recorded. The second album is ready to put down, and we've started demoing for that. So there's a lot of finished songs that are, you know, a lot like what's on this album, but just kind of a step further. And then I'm always writing, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Al told me that if I like this one, wait till you hear the next one. Now, of course, you know, forgive me for being a little jaded about statements from managers, you know, of course, because that's what he's paid
like
to say, right?
Child.
But I'll tell you what, I popped the CD in the player and my eyes went wide, and I just thought, well, you know, maybe he's right, you know, because this first one is a killer CD. So let's talk about it just a little bit. Even the Sparrow, as you said, as we said earlier, every song is original on it, and you're playing the banjo. Let's talk a little bit about the banjo. I know that it has a provenance that, you know, it wasn't bought at Walmart. Let's put it that way.
Right. So, yes, shortly after I moved to Kansas City, I was just playing this little kind of starter five-string Fender banjo that I had gotten, and started playing around on some open mics, and a local guy named Lance Steele, he's a musician and has a whole bunch of really beautiful, cool, old instruments, just a personal collection. And he approached me after a show one night with a banjo case in his hand and said, hey, really enjoy your music. Are you looking for another banjo? And I said, no, I'm really not, but, you know, I'll take a look. And he opened up this case, and it was this little tenor banjo like I'd never seen. Short scale length, you know, just a little 17-fret banjo, and its original calfskin leather head. And it had a little note in there saying it was played by a man named Ira Tam and his Dog and Pony Show from 1920 to 1935.
Whoa.
And I'm a sucker for history. I'm a sucker for, you know, stories and antiques. And I just fell in love with this banjo, and I took it home with me. And songs just, we bonded. Songs started coming out of that banjo. And so that is the primary banjo that I recorded the album on. It's a great recording banjo. It's not a great touring banjo just because it's so old, and with the calfskin head, it's really hard to kind of keep it in tune, and I worry about damaging it traveling and all that, so I don't take it with me on the road, but it's my primary banjo that I use on the album, and it's got a really sweet, warm, mellow tone that was unlike anything I'd heard come out of a banjo before.
Huh, what do you think accounts for that? Just the head itself, or just...
Well, I think a number of things. I mean, I don't know who made it. It's an anonymous make. I think it's possibly a Stromberg Voisinet. Those were kind of big in the 1920s in Chicago area, but I really don't know, you know, much of its history beyond the story that came with it. But I think the calfskin head, that it has a very natural, I mean, it's a natural fiber. And so it's got just intrinsically this sort of warm, earthy, just sweet sound, and that's that, along with the solid wood that makes up the, you know, the body of the instrument and the resonator and the fretboard, that all just kind of, as the wood and the leather ages, it just gains character. So yeah, I can actually still see where Ira Tam, where he played the banjo, because his oils from his hands are still in that banjo head.
Whoa.
So it absorbs things. It sort of ages in a way that makes it sweeter, I think. And yeah, there's just something special about its sound. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting that you don't take it out on the road with you. I guess you don't want to put a hole in it like Willie Nelson has in Trigger. No hole in your banjo.
No, I want to get as many albums out of this thing as I can. And, right. And you know, the banjos are notorious for the head is constantly contracting and expanding with heat and with barometric pressure. And already on this trip, you know, we've gone to 10,000 feet above sea level to sea level, and you know, over a matter of a couple days, and our temperature fluctuations have been vast. We've covered, you know, we're covering a lot of miles, and so I literally have had nightmares about opening up my banjo case and seeing that my banjo head has split. With the dry, being in the dryness of the mountains and stuff. So, yeah, I just don't risk it with Ira, but I did another weird story about the banjos. A year after I got Ira, between a year and 2 years after I got Ira, I got a call from a friend in Nashville. He said, hey, a buddy of mine has this incredible tenor banjo. Are you looking for another tenor banjo? And I said, no, I've got one I absolutely adore. There's no way I would want another one. And he said, well, let me send you pictures. And sent me pictures of this banjo that was a twin to Ira, except it was in mint condition and it had a Mylar, like a snare drum kind of metallic sounding head. So it's much more percussive and it projects a lot better. But same markings, same headstock, same dimensions, everything about this banjo was a twin to this mystery banjo that already fell into my lap once. And so it felt cosmic. Of course, I had to get the banjo, and now that's my traveling banjo, is Ira's twin, Soli. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow, funny. I love that. I love that story. Yeah. That kind of synchronicity counts for something, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm supposed to be playing these banjos, these old 1920s tenors. That's just my thing.
Now, can you say the same with the person who accompanies you on stage, Stosh?
Oh, Stosh, yeah, Stosh Haney. He's wonderful. I mean, I'm really fortunate to make music with him. We met 3-4 years ago, shortly after I'd moved to Kansas City and I'd kind of been playing solo for a while. And actually, the title track off the album, Even the Sparrow, I was playing that at an open mic in Kansas City. And he, you know, just stopped into this open mic with his violin, and it was very free form kind of jam setting where you could just hop up with your instrument and join in or whatever. And so he heard me playing Even the Sparrow, and it just kind of clicked in his brain. He knew exactly what the song was, you know, what he could add to it, and he just heard it. And so he got up on stage with me and started playing, and it was just kind of this weird little moment. And I remember someone came up to me afterwards and said, you know, you two should be making music together, right? And there was just an energy and a connection, and we just kind of spoke the same musical language. And so little by little, you know, I was starting to get some gigs, and I invited him to join me on a couple gigs, and he started learning my songs, and one thing led to the next. And then we were in the studio together, and he was recording on the album with me, and he co-produced the album with me as well. So, he's been a big part of kind of the behind the scenes, lending his ear. He's got a great, great ear. And, that's kind of how we work together. And he's playing an old violin from Germany from 1883. So again, I mean, it's got so much depth, and, it's a very warm, dark, sounding violin. It's just got so much character. So that, and my guitar too is an old 1920s. So just all of our instruments, except for my 5-string, are elders.
Except for your voice.
Except for my voice. You're right. You're right.
But your voice works so well with those old instruments.
Yeah, there's something about the timbre. It really, really does mix. And even sometimes Stosh's violin, when he's harmonizing with my voice, sometimes it sounds like another human voice. I mean, the tones of our instruments really lock in. So it's fascinating. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, I hope that you don't change things too much for a second album. You know, some people, some artists, a lot of artists, you know, suffer from a sophomore slump. And I think it's because the first one comes along and everybody gets absolutely bowled over by it. And it will never, ever compare to anything that you do subsequently. I mean, I think, for instance, of Mary Gaucher, her first one, Drag Queens and Limousines, was just so amazing. And, you know, nothing will ever compare in terms of that. So I hope that I hope that you managed to avoid that. And it sounds like just because of the way that you're going about things, you will.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. It's something I think about a lot. And I'm very impatient by nature. You know, it's hard for me to finish a song just because I start so many fires and then I have to go back and be disciplined and, you know, but there's a whole body. I mean, really the second album, it's a lot of songs that came out of really the same period of writing and into sort of the next one, but I'm just catching up with myself because there, yeah, were just a lot of songs that floodgates kind of opened when I finally let them. You know, I ran away from music for 5 or 6 years and was trying on a lot of different hats and trying to focus on a career path and just nothing was panning out because music is really what I wanted to do all along, I think, and I just had to come to terms with that. So there was a lot of tension, you know, creatively in that time that gave birth to a lot of songs, and the second album really is all songs that came out of that same kind of of a period. So yeah, I think it will very much be a natural continuation from the first. And what I really love about, you know, this first album too is just I'm big about just letting the songs dictate what they need from a production and sort of engineering standpoint, you know, not overproducing a song, only adding as many instrumental layers and sort of surrounding things as it needs to feel full and complete, but that it's okay if a song is sparse. You know, sometimes a song shines when there aren't too many things cluttering it up. So I will definitely carry that philosophy through to the second album and sort of just let the songs dictate what they need.
How long can the field go without rain? How long can a bird fly without touching down again? Worth my salt in a long haul, and I know you're worth the wait. So when will we be together? How long can the flower grow without sun? How long can the dam all hold back the rising flood? Down in mud. So when will we be together? We drank from the bitter cup of self-denial. And out of the gate I let you set the pace and I matched you mile for mile. Running on the fumes is what we do. We could probably keep them going for a while.